Hello everyone, and thank you for joining me for this extended podcast as I take a look at the influence of religious beliefs on healthcare practice. Now, before I begin, I'd like to say a very big thank you to Joyce Ruman. Joyce is a specialist in medical sociology and works as a lecturer at the Faculty of Social Sciences at the Benue State University in Nigeria. I'd like to thank Joyce for carrying out all of the research and writing the paper that this podcast is based on. Now, the purpose of this podcast really is to consider the relationship between religion and healthcare in order to suggest how physicians and other healthcare providers should respond when the faith-based preference of a patient clashes with the medically indicated treatment modalities. The patient and practitioner really need to understand each other's vantage point, I guess you could say. In a nutshell, the patient knows that the doctor certainly intends what is best for that patient and does not believe that the doctor knows best, potentially, in that instance. Only God does. The doctor can clearly spell out what the symptoms mean and what test results show, for example, and what medicine indicates by way of treatment, and the patient does understand that. Religion is a subject that we encounter daily because we follow a specific faith and the rules established by it. Religion is not only researchable as such, but it's also of essential interest to clinicians, to doctors, to patients, and health psychologists. Religion has the benefit of empowering the individual through connecting him or her to a community and to a, I guess you could say, a superior force that might in turn give psychological stability. This ability to empower could be used by health workers to help those who struggle with a disease or to promote a healthier lifestyle. This, I guess you could say, empowering happens through consciousness of religious principles, such as the sanctity of human life, shared identity, meaningful roles in the community and society at large, a variety of spiritual, social and economic support, social networks and even leadership for social change and protection in time of conflicts. The field of health sociology at large should move towards promoting culture as a means of understanding between healthcare providers and patients in the interest of prevention as well. In healthcare literature, religion and spirituality are most of the times used interchangeably, although they have different meanings. That's certainly according to researchers Adams and Lieberlands in their work of 1986. Spirituality is defined in individual terms, characterized by experiences involving meaning, connectedness, and transcendence, whereas religion is defined in communal terms, characterized by institutionalized practices and beliefs, membership and modes of organization. Therefore, whereas spirituality is understood at the level of the individual, I guess we could argue that religion is more of a social phenomenon and as such is included in the more overarching concept of spirituality. Religion can also be conceptualized as religiousness, as an individual phenomenon, characterized by the adherence of an individual to specific beliefs and to specific practices. I just want to delve into the idea of spirituality just a little bit more. Spirituality is more frequently described than it is defined. In fact, the word derives from the Latin word spirare, which means to breathe. In modern usage, it includes such a wide range of human experience, traditional religions, New Age teachings, personal mystical experience and the quest for the meaning of life. Spirituality appears to be a multidimensional construct in which a few core concepts repeatedly emerge. Spirituality implies that there is a deeper dimension to human life, an inner world of the soul. It assumes that humans are fundamentally spiritual beings, living in a spiritual as well as physical universe. Spirituality is about the inner life or the spirit of each of us, and it relates to the unseen world of spirit or of God. According to researcher Thomas Merton, spirituality includes at least two basic concepts, union with God and transformation of consciousness. The Desert Fathers experienced Spirituality is the struggle for the divine encounter and for the human identity. It has also been described as that range of activities in which people cooperatively interact with God. Psychiatrist Andrew Sims proposes that spirituality includes at least five domains: meaning in life, or what a person lives for essentially, interrelatedness, wholeness, morality, and an awareness of God. I think it's important that we look at spirituality before we really start to delve a little bit deeper into essentially religion. Now, religion, however, is communal. It's particular and it's defined by boundaries. It is spiritually incarnated at the social and cultural level, though. Religion takes the boundless and it binds it into the limitations of language and culture, even as it may also transform culture. The word religion derives from religio, to bind back or to tie. Like spirituality, the term religion has suffered from a multiplicity of definitions. The term religion is increasingly used by scholars in the narrow sense of institutionally based dogma, rituals and traditions. Kenneth Pargament in 97 defined religion broadly as the search for significance in ways related to the sacred, encompassing both the personal and social, traditional and non-traditional forms of the religious search. Pargament uses the term spirituality to describe what he calls the central function of religion, that is, the search for the sacred. A researcher on religion and healthcare, Dare Matthews, defined religion as an organized system of beliefs and practices and symbols designed to facilitate closeness to God. So religion is any set of beliefs and practices concerning our relationship with the sacred. But what is the influence of spirituality and religion on health? Well, there are four prominent pathways in which religion influences health. Health behaviours, so through prescribing a certain diet and or discouraging the abuse of alcoholic beverages, smoking, etc. So religion can sort of protect and promote a healthy lifestyle as such. Social support, where people can experience social contact with co-religionists and have a web of social relations that can help and protect whenever the case. Psychological states. So religious people can experience a better mental health, more positive psychological states, more optimism, more faith, which in turn can lead to a better physical state due to being less stressed, basically. And what we call psi influences. So supernatural laws that govern energies not currently comprehended by science, but possibly understandable at some point by science. Because spirituality and religion influences health through these pathways, they act in an indirect way on health. There is increasing recognition within contemporary Western medicine of the significant links between spirituality and religion and health, and the need for health professionals to understand their patients' spiritual and religious beliefs and practices. Religion is usually seen as the institutionalization of shared beliefs and customary practices. It's often integrated into a community's cultural life. Most religions have traditional beliefs and practices relating to healthy living, illness, and death. Religion differs from spirituality because spirituality is generally perceived as more fluid, eclectic, I guess you could say, and individualized. Spirituality and religion are not necessarily mutually exclusive because a significant proportion of the population identified as being spiritual but not religious in a 2001 study by researcher Hilbers. In identifying spiritual or religious needs in the hospital context, health professionals are attempting to gain an understanding of two broad issues. Firstly, beliefs or practices which are significant to the patient's health that can affect decision-making, coping, support networks, commitment to treatment regimens, use of complementary health practices and general well-being. And secondly, patients' wishes about the way their beliefs and practices are acknowledged and supported whilst they are in hospital. Health personnel's inquiry about the spiritual beliefs and practices of patients should not offend those without such beliefs if inquiry is done in a sensitive and a respectful manner. If patients indicate that religious or spiritual beliefs are not important in their lives, then the spiritual history should end, and the health practitioner should explore what factors provide meaning and purpose and support for that particular patient. Religion is certainly not the only source of fulfillment for basic existential and psychological needs during illness. So such a transition from religious focus to a sort of non-religious one should be done so smoothly and seamlessly that the non-religious patient really does hardly notice it at all. If there is indication that the patient has religious conflicts or struggles, however, then these need to be brought out into the open, because they may worsen the course of the illness and adversely affect medical outcomes, because the focus is always on maintaining and maximizing the health of the patient. I'd like to look at this point in the podcast some of patients' existential questions. So, for example, is it common for patients to have existential questions about their illness? And many do inquire, well, why me, when given a devastating diagnosis? Well, a sick patient may feel that the medical illness is a punishment from God. This is so because if devout religious faith is a pathway to good health and protection from all diseases, let's say, then it is believed that the illness or sickness results from lack of devotion to that said faith. This notion can be harmful to the patient in question, because the patient believes that the illness has come upon him or her as a result of a lack of devotion, and thereby affects how the patient views the sickness, how they view the treatments, and how to gain good health. In other words, such questions as why me may actually affect health outcomes. Physical and mental illnesses have many causes: genetic, developmental, accidental, traumatic, that have nothing whatsoever at all to do with religion or faith. Even the most devoutly religious people end up getting sick and dying. Are not all the saints and martyrs now dead? Well, it's often not until a person becomes sick, experiences tragedy, or goes through some period of great suffering that deep religious faith emerges out of the struggle. Consequently, those with the most advanced illnesses often end up being those who are the most spiritual. So it's impossible, I guess you could say, and often completely wrong, to conclude that a patient's poor physical health is due to a lack of faith, and health practitioners should never imply this. Rather, proper arrangements should be made for counsellors, clergy, etc., who would counsel patients with such beliefs to make them accept their condition as natural and not a punishment from a supernatural being for the lack of devotion towards them. Now, the main or the core focus, if you like, of this podcast is how religious beliefs actually affect healthcare. So I would like to look at some diverse religions and their beliefs about health, diet, illness, and death. So I'd like to start with the Baha'i. Now, the Baha'i faith began in the Near East in the middle of the last century, since when it has established itself throughout the world. Its founder, Baha'u'llah, I might have been pronouncing that incorrect. So anyone of the Baha'i faith, apologies if I have pronounced that incorrectly, lived from a period of 1817 through to 1892, and it's regarded as the messenger of God. Now, his teachings center on the unity of humankind and of religions, and include the harmony of religion and science, the equality of women and men, and the abolition of prejudice. The faith has no clergy, and its affairs are in the hands of elected administrative bodies known as spiritual assemblies. Although the Baha'i faith has its roots in Babism, a Muslim denomination, it is a separate religion. Its teachings centre on the unity of mankind, the harmony of religion and science, equality of men and women, as I said, and universal peace. It has no set doctrines, no priesthood, no formal public ritual, and no authoritative scriptures. However, a patient may wish to have a visitor from the spiritual assembly of the Baha'i. There are no unusual requirements for a Baha'i patient in hospital. He or she accepts the usual routines and treatment. So what about health and healing? Well, Baha'i is of the belief that we're placed in this world to grow and to develop spiritually. So illness, like other tests, may be means to grow, and it should be approached on both the material and the spiritual planes. So they believe in the power of prayer, but have no objection to medical practice. The Baha'u'llah leader instructed his followers, "Whenever ye fall ill, refer to competent physicians." Now, under normal circumstances, the Baha'i abstain from alcohol and other harmful or habit-forming drugs, but it is permitted when prescribed as a bona fide part of the actual treatment that they may need. So narcotics would similarly be permitted for medical reasons, like the control of pain, prescribed by a doctor. They're encouraged by the teachings of their faith not to smoke, for their own good and for that of others. And there's no special requirements as far as food and the diet are concerned. Some are vegetarians, but again, that's a matter of individual choice. The abstention from alcohol is strict, and that extends to cooking as well. So things like wine sauces, sherry trifle, for example, are forbidden. Such items do not usually form part of the hospital diet. Members of the faith observe a period of fasting each year. So members of the Baha'i faith fast from a period that's around 2nd of March to the 21st of March. So the fast is from sunrise to sunset. The ill are exempted, as are children, the elderly, and expectant and nursing mothers. If a patient is fasting, arrangements need to be made ultimately to have food available before dawn and after dusk. There is no objection to the giving or receiving of blood transfusions or of organ transplants. Donations of organs after death for transplanting to others in need is actually regarded as praiseworthy. The termination of pregnancy is permitted only where there are strong medical grounds, such as risk to life and health of the mother. It is not regarded lightly, and it's not permitted as a social or contraceptive measure. Whether it is acceptable in any specific case is for consultation between the patient and her medical attendant in the light of that guidance. The rearing of children is regarded as one of the main reasons for the institution of marriage, but the details and extent of contraceptive practice, again, are left to the conscience of the couple. Many Baha'i will not use the uterine device, or the IUD as it's known, for contraception, as they regard it as more of a sort of abortive fasciant, I guess you could argue, than a contraceptive. There are no specific Baha'i teachings on withholding or removing life support in disabling or terminal illness, where this support is being given merely to prolong life. It is also left to the conscience of the individual whether or not to subscribe to a living will. Baha'i believe that after death, the body should be treated with respect. They believe in an afterlife, and therefore they treat the body with not just great respect, but they perform routine last rites. Embalming is therefore not allowed. Cremation is not permitted, and burial normally takes place as near as possible to the place of death, certainly within the distance of an hour's transport, let's say. There is no objection to necessary post-mortem examination, provided that stipulations are met. Its members will welcome lay people and members of other religions as well. Ultimately, the belief really stems from this idea of cooperation and just mutual understanding, especially in a place like a hospital, and that far outweighs any differences of doctrine and practice. So let's move to another religion. So at this point, I'd like to talk about Buddhism. Buddhist faith centres on the Buddha, who is revered not as a god but as an example of a way of life. Buddhists believe in reincarnation and so accept responsibility for their actions. The chief doctrine is that of karma, good or evil deeds resulting in appropriate reward or punishment, either in this life or through reincarnation along a succession of lives. From its very beginning, Buddhism has always been culturally adaptable, and as a result, a variety of forms and movements have developed within the religion, each with different traditions. As Buddhism encourages its followers to practice non-violence, Buddhists will mostly be vegetarian. Meals will vary considerably depending upon their country of origin. Buddhists believe that life begins at conception, and so do not condemn contraception. However, as abortion and active euthanasia are seen as taking life, they are condemned. Blood transfusion and organ transplantation are allowed. Buddhists believe that in rebirth, after death, the state of mind of a person at the moment of death is important, because that determines the state of rebirth. They like to have full information about their imminent death to enable them to make preparation. Some Buddhists may wish to have sedatives or painkilling drugs administered at the time. Peace and quiet for meditation and visits from other Buddhists will be appreciated. Some form of chanting may be used to influence the state of mind at death, so that it may be peaceful. In the situation where death occurs, if other Buddhists are not in attendance, then a Buddhist minister should be informed of the death as soon as possible. Again, routine last rites are appropriate. Cremation is preferred, and post-mortem is very unlikely to be objected. Established in the United States of America in 1879, Christian Science teaches a reliance on God for healing rather than on medicine or surgery. And this is what I'd like to talk about now in the podcast. It will be unusual, therefore, for Christian scientists to be patients in ordinary hospitals. They will usually seek nursing care at home or in a Christian Science nursing home. They may, however, be admitted to hospital following accidents or during pregnancy and childbirth, and because of family or legal pressures. They will accept medical care for their children where the law requires them to do so. The church does not attempt to control the actions of its members, and the decision about whether to accept medical intervention lies within, again, the individual. A Christian scientist will appreciate the normal care of the hospital if it is necessary for him or her to be admitted, but will normally wish to be totally free of drug treatment. He or she will probably wish to contact a Christian Science practitioner for treatment through prayer. The patient will appreciate privacy for prayer and access the holy books of the Christian Science faith. As you can imagine, alcohol and tobacco are not allowed. Strict Christian scientists may not drink tea or coffee. Blood transfusion is not normally acceptable for adults, but parents usually consent to transfusion for their child if doctors consider it essential. An organ transplantation is not normally acceptable for adults to donate or to receive organs. There are no rituals to be performed for the dying, and routine last rites are appropriate at death. A female body should be handled by female staff. Cremation is usually preferred, and in regards to post-mortem, Christian scientists do object to post-mortems unless it again is required by law. So what about Christianity more generally? Well, although the doctrines of the Christian churches vary greatly both within and between countries, there are four features of Christianity that are nearly universal: initiation or baptism, worship, ministry, and good works. The sacred writings of Christian religion are in the Bible. A Christian's individual faith and religious practice will be influenced by the tradition of the church to which they belong, as well as their own personal relationship to God. in terms of diet. There's no general dietary requirements. Some Christians observe Friday as a day when they don't eat meat. Some Christians may wish to abstain from food or fast before receiving Holy Communion, and some abstain from alcohol. Family planning varies from religion to religion. There are no religious objections about blood transfusion and organ transplantation. Routine last rites again can be appropriate for all Christians after death. There is no age limit for baptism. When babies or children are very ill, baptism should be offered. With regards to Roman Catholics and baptism, a layperson may perform this ceremony if death is imminent. In the absence of a minister of religion, anyone may perform a baptism. That's done by making the sign of the cross on a person's forehead. A little water is poured on the forehead or another accessible part of the body with the words, well, name of the person, I baptize you in the name of the Father and the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. A Catholic patient will probably wish to be visited by a Catholic priest and to receive Holy Communion and the sacrament of the sick. This is not only for the dying, but also just for the sick. Especially before an operation. The sacraments are very important. The Catholic priest must be called to the dying patient, and if the death is sudden, immediately afterwards. The chaplain should be informed as soon as possible. If a child dies unbaptized, the chaplain will offer a blessing, a naming service, and a certificate to commemorate this will be given to the parents. This is particularly appropriate following a miscarriage or a stillbirth. Christmas and Easter are the most important festivals or celebrations, so Christians will usually wish to receive Holy Communion at those times. There is no religious objection also about post-mortem. In Islam, great importance is attached to cleanliness. Therefore, before every act of prayer, the patient will want to wash his or her face and hands and feet. Times of prayer are dawn, noon, mid-afternoon, just before sunset and before retiring for sleep. The patient will need to stand, if they can, on clean sheets or a prayer mat facing Mecca or southeast. Privacy will be appreciated, but it's not essential. An offer of a copy of the Quran would be appreciated. This must be handled with great respect, no object or book being placed upon it. This can be supplied if sourced by a local mosque. Both male and female Muslims are very modest in their dress and outlook. A female may request that she is examined by a female doctor or nurse, or that a husband or a female companion be present during a medical examination. In terms of the diet, both pork and alcohol are forbidden in all forms all year round. Halal meal is required, otherwise kosher or seafood and a vegetarian meal. During the month of Ramadan, according to the Muslim calendar, all Muslims fast by not eating or drinking from dawn to sunset, but ill patients are exempt from that. Food should be made available for any fasting patient before dawn and after sunset. The taking of medication during a fasting day may cause difficulties to the patient. No undue pressure should be applied. It should be discussed with the patient and their family. Hands, feet and mouth, as I alluded to before, are always washed before prayer. Hand washing is considered essential before eating. Water for washing is needed in the same room as the toilet itself, i.e. patients should be provided with bowls or jugs of water. If a bedpan has to be used, then bowls or jugs of water should be provided again. Patients prefer to wash in free-flowing water, such as a shower. Baths are considered unhygienic. If a shower is unavailable, then ask the patient if they would like to use a jug in the bath. Women prefer to be treated by female staff where appropriate. A locket containing religious writing is sometimes worn around the neck in a small leather bag. They are kept for protection and strength and therefore should never be removed. In respect to family planning, strictly speaking, Orthodox Muslims do not approve of contraception in practice, although individuals vary widely in their approach. Abortion is frowned upon, but it is often tolerated if for medical reasons. And as I've mentioned about blood transfusions with other religions, in Islam there is no religious objection. There's no specific rulings prohibiting transplantation either. However, strict Muslims will likely not agree to organ transplants. In terms of pregnancy, immediately after the birth, the father or other family members would read a short prayer while holding the infant. Muslim women are encouraged to breastfeed. Contraception is accepted by many Muslims with the consent of the couple and if the method itself is safe. Abortion or termination of pregnancy is only allowed if there is a serious medical condition for the mother. The older the pregnancy, the more difficult the ethical issue, and days 40 and 120 of pregnancy are important milestones. If a member of Islam is dying, then they may wish to sit or lay facing Mecca and reading the Quran. Family or friends may wish to quietly read the Quran or say a prayer also. After death, the body should not be touched by non-Muslims. Health workers who need to touch the body should wear disposable gloves. The body should be prepared according to the wishes of the family. The body should be wrapped in one or two plain white sheets. The foot of the bed is placed facing Mecca, or the patient is turned onto their right side in order that the deceased's face is looking towards Mecca, and the body is not allowed to be washed, nor the cutting of nails or hair. The family and the local mosques are contacted to handle washing of the body in the hospital or at the funeral house, and then a prayer at the mosque or at the Muslim section of the cemetery. Cremation is not allowed, and the burial should take place ideally within 24 hours. Some Muslims do oppose post-mortem, but no restrictions are typically found if it's required by law. But there are special considerations. There are many Muslim festivals, all calculated by the lunar calendar. There is a need to ask the patient or family if an important occasion for their faith occurs during their stay in hospital. The most important is the month of Ramadan, during which Muslims practice self-discipline in order to achieve tolerance, love, sacrifice, and equality. There are two more religions that I'd like to cover in this particular podcast. Judaism, but before that, Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, Jehovah's Witnesses try to live their lives according to the commands of God as written in the Old and New Testaments. They regard Jesus Christ as the Son of God, but not in the sense of being equal with God or one with God. In terms of, again, and I'll just follow the kind of same pattern with the other religions. So let's talk about diet to begin with. Food containing blood or blood products is totally unacceptable. Jehovah's Witnesses will not accept or take those, and they will not smoke. Jehovah's Witnesses have very strong religious views that taking blood into one's body is morally wrong and is therefore prohibited. So blood transfusions are just a no-go, and that includes whole blood and its components, such as just red blood cells, plasma, white cells, or platelets. Jehovah's Witnesses can choose whether to accept products such as albumin, immunoglobulins or antibodies as they're known, or clotting factors. Blood samples may be taken for pathological testing, providing any unused blood is disposed of. Dialysis is usually accepted. Jehovah's Witnesses accept medical treatment in all other respects apart from those involving the use of blood or blood components. Organ transplantation is generally not permitted. Components where blood is not involved, so for example like the corneas, are more likely to be acceptable. Jehovah's Witnesses are not likely to be willing either to donate or to receive an organ through which blood flows. They will want reassurance that blood will not be used against their wishes. There are no special rituals for the dying, but they will usually appreciate a visit from one of the elders of their faith. There's no separate clergy. Routine last rites here are not appropriate, and in terms of post-mortem, that really is a matter of individual choice for the family. And finally for this podcast, I'd like to consider Judaism. Now, in Judaism, religion and culture are entwined. It's based on the worship of one God, carrying out the Ten Commandments and the practice of charity and tolerance towards one fellow's human beings. There are different groups within Judaism. The Orthodox Jews are usually more traditional and observant of the religious and dietary laws. Non-Orthodox Jews, including conservative or liberal Reform Jews, make their religious observance fit into modern society. With regards to diet, many Jews will ask for kosher food, i.e. meat that has been prepared in a special way according to Jewish law. Shellfish, pork, rabbit and derivatives are strictly prohibited. Milk and meat products are not eaten in the same meal. This means that they do not have milk in their drinks or cream with any desserts after their meat meal, and do not use butter on meat sandwiches. The patient should be consulted over his or her level of dietary observance, and the necessary arrangements should be made. Orthodox Jews may not be happy to take non-kosher medication. If fasting would be a danger, even Orthodox patients will accept medical advice. Orthodox Jewish women would prefer to have their bodies and limbs covered. They may also prefer to keep their hair covered with a headscarf, while Orthodox men keep their head covered with a hat or a skull cap or a kippah. Some Orthodox Jews forbid contraception or family planning unless the woman's health is at risk. Nearly all Jewish boys are circumcised, usually 8 days after birth. That's performed by a trained and medically certified religious functionary called a mohel. If there is any doubt about the child's health, then the circumcision is delayed. Organ transplants are usually forbidden by Orthodox Jews. However, opinions vary and decisions may rest with the rabbi and associated authority. When a member of the Jewish religion is dying, then that patient may wish to recite or hear special psalms or prayers, especially Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd," and may appreciate being able to hold the page on which it is written. Prayers may be said by the relatives, and they may wish that a rabbi be called to help the dying person with their formal confession and to bring comfort. In some cases, the son or nearest relative, if present, may wish to close the eyes or mouth of the deceased. The body should be handled as little as possible by non-Jews. Depending on the sex of the patient, a fellow male or female washes and prepares the body for burial. Usually three members of the community are present here. Traditional Jews will arrange for this to be done by the Jewish Burial Society. However, if members of the family are not present, then most non-Orthodox Jews would accept the usual washing and last rites performed by the hospital staff. The body is covered with a clean white sheet. The family may wish for the body to be placed with the feet pointing towards the doorway and to light a candle. Some Orthodox Jewish groups may wish to appoint someone to stay with the body from the time of death to the burial, which usually takes place within a 24-hour period. This person is called a watcher, and he or she may need to stay with the body throughout the night. In the above instance, or if the family wish to view the body, staff should ask the mortician to ensure that the room is free of any religious symbols. If the death has to be reported to the coroner, she or he should be informed that the patient was Jewish and asked if the procedures can take place as soon as possible. Orthodox Jews are always buried, but non-Orthodox Jews are allowed to be cremated. The funeral has to take place as soon as possible. Postmortems are not permitted unless, again, legally required. There are, as with other religions, special considerations. The Sabbath or the Shabbat begins at sunset on Friday and lasts until sunset on the Saturday. On the Sabbath, work is prohibited, and this includes things such as writing, travelling, even switching on lights or electrical appliances. Passover, in March or April time, is when special foods may be required by some Jewish patients. The Day of Atonement or Yom Kippur, in September or October time, is a special day of fasting, and so a Jewish patient will normally wish to keep that day for prayer and to be quiet. It is the holiest day of the Jewish calendar, and it's considered to be the set path for the year to follow. Orthodox patients must be offered alternatives to oral medication, such as injections or suppositories. So there's just a few special considerations for the Jewish religion. Most patients don't know the difference between religion and spirituality, and they tend to understand religion and spirituality as the same thing. There are also beliefs about spirits, spiritual beings, or spiritual forces that can induce psychological or even physical harm to people, as in voodoo or witchcraft. Belief in demonic or evil spirits may lead to great distress in patients from spiritual traditions in which such forces are emphasised and where there is belief that people can become inhabited by such spirits. Spiritual practices such as transcendental meditation, mindfulness, meditation, healing touch involving subtle energies, acupuncture may at times be offered to Christian patients as part of alternative or complementary medicine programs. Such spiritual practices may be presented by practitioners with an almost evangelical zeal to patients who are desperate for help after allopathic medical treatments have failed. Patients from conservative Christian groups may know very little about such practices, which are rooted in Eastern or New Age religious traditions and may directly conflict with their Christian religious beliefs. Health practitioners are not knowledgeable about or insensitive to conservative Christian beliefs and may impose these foreign spiritual practices on patients without fully explaining their origins and without providing traditional Christian alternatives more consistent with patients' beliefs, such as prayer, visit with a chaplain, or access to religious services or religious literature like the Bible. Devout Muslim patients may likewise be offended when spiritual practices rooted in Eastern or New Age religious traditions are offered to them. Spirituality or religion can be incorporated into health practice by engaging with and listening to patients and their families. By acknowledging their beliefs and gaining an understanding of how to relate to their health, being attentive to clues about spiritual and religious beliefs, and being attentive to their practices is a really useful start for health practitioners. Clues may be just comments or actions, possessions, or clothing with spiritual or religious significance. Healthcare staff can ask patients where they get their strength from, who or what supports them in life. Just non-intrusive but open questions. Patient spiritual or religious needs should be documented, and all health care team members should understand them. It will enable their needs to be integrated into the treatment planning and care. That may include supporting rituals, customs, or other valued practices, and or working in partnership with the pastoral care workers and chaplains or representatives from a patient's religious community. I guess to conclude, I'd like to just finish with this kind of idea. Incorporating spirituality or religion into healthcare requires the same skills that competent practitioners already use in the delivery of person-centered care. These skills are underpinned by the principles of respect and collaboration. Besides the many positive effects that religion or spirituality may have on health, they can also have negative effects. Believers and non-believers may experience subtle psychological, social, and spiritual strains related to their religious beliefs that distress them, their family. They could refuse life-saving procedures and stop necessary medication, choosing faith instead of medicine. Health practitioners need to learn to respect those decisions that patients make based on their religious beliefs and not become offended or feel rejected. Instead, they should try to enter into a patient's religious worldview in order to better understand the logic of their decision. Only in this way can the door of communication truly be kept open between the health practitioner and the religious patient. Health practitioners should obtain training in understanding the religious or spiritual issues concerning patients' health in order to address such areas that may be of vital importance to many patients, not only in terms of their psychological and social well-being, but also their physical health. On that note, I'd like to say a big thank you to everybody for listening to this rather extended podcast. And again, a big thank you to Joyce Ruman, lecturer at the Benue State University in Nigeria, for providing the content for me to use for this particular podcast. Thanks again. Until next time.